They are both examples of a standard candle. The Cepheids were the first ones to be primarily used, and they're useful in closer constellations. The Type 1A supernovas were probably the second that was used, and they're much more effective farther away because their luminosity is so much brighter than a Cepheid star that at a greater distance you can still pick them up with a halfway decent telescope.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
The Cepheids were very important because, once they discovered that there was a woman, Vera Rubin, she would look at all these photographic plates and finally figured out that these were variable stars, like you said before, and then they used them for distance. It became a standard candle. But the most important use of it was when they looked at the Andromeda galaxy, and they thought that was a nebula. They thought that was, you know, within our own galaxy. They didn't know there was anything beyond our galaxy. And they saw inside that galaxy with the telescope, they could see that there was a separate, you know, going on and off, pulsing, and they knew at that point this thing was like not within our galaxy, but it was over 2.5 million light years away. So that was really the beginning of learning, you know, that galaxies are really out there. They're not part of our own galaxy. It's not a cloud. Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, like most things, it starts off very local, where the ancient Greeks thought that the sun was something like 1/400th the distance that it is, and they probably, most of them believed that all the constellations were not that much higher above in those crystal spheres. So yeah, every single new discovery, new trick leads to more information. The Cepheids were very important in discerning local galaxies, and the 1A supernovas were very important in disillusioning us all that the Hubble constant is going in the wrong direction and the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate.
Questions?
Yes, certainly, Paul.
Not too long ago, I'm not sure where I read this, but they said that they're using galaxies as a standard candle now. It's even gotten to the point where the 1A supernovas aren't good enough. They know a certain shape of a galaxy should, you know, certain types of galaxies, there's different types of galaxies. But let's say it's a spiral. They have a good idea of how much brightness that whole galaxy will be illuminated. So by that, they can tell even further, going, you know, back into billions of years, billions of light years, how far those galaxies are now away. But I think they're using the galaxies themselves as a standard candle now. Back to you, Roy.
I don't know if it qualifies as a true standard candle. What they're doing is what they did with the HR diagrams for stars. They tracked enough stars to be able to give a ballpark figure of luminosity, and with true luminosity, and then you detected what the apparent luminosity, you plug it in and you get a distance, and you also get a surmise of mass. So they probably do the same phenomena once they've mapped a few hundred galaxies to kind of break them into different groups and then put them on a curve and extrapolate. But they always like to cross-correlate, and if something is proven to be consistent through a bunch of different methods. They're much happier than relying on any one single method. But the candle is the, you know, is the gold standard. And I think at this point it's the Cepheids and the 1A supernovas that qualify as a candle standard.
Okay, so now how do we get back to this 13.7, I think now, billion light years to the beginning? What gets us to that distance? Are you saying the 1As are doing that, or is it just the redshifts of the galaxies? How are they getting that distance?
Well, a bunch of different ways. The recent correction to 13.8, I think, was done due to the correction of the 1A supernovas that gave the shift in the curve more accurately, and they've extrapolated it to 13.8. But, I mean, they have changed the Hubble constant and with it the age of the universe many, many times, and they might still do it again if they find something far enough away to give more correction. Just recently, a superluminal supernova was detected at a calculated distance of 3.2 billion light years away. So, they just keep on looking, and they'll keep on finding things, and they'll keep on perfecting Hubble's constant. And it's all subject to change, unfortunately, but probably not by too much.
Roy, has there been any attempt to use a gamma ray burst as a kind of a standard candle? Because I believe a gamma ray burst, which is now thought to be a pair of neutron stars that are in binary circulation around each other, and when they combine, they give you a gamma ray burst that was detected by the LIGO. Laser interferometry gravitational wave detector. So a gamma ray burst, I am guessing, might be more intense than a 1A supernova. And although they're more rare, because it's brighter, we might be able to detect them at a greater distance. And I think there's a chance that that could become a standard candle. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, it may be possible. I'm sure there's a lot of clever people in this field of science, and they're perpetually going over the past stuff, trying to figure new tricks. It's kind of incredible the number of tricks that they've already figured out, but that doesn't mean that there aren't more tricks to be found. I'm really looking forward to a greater use of gravitational waves, because if you think about it, everything that I've discussed tonight is based on pretty much electromagnetic radiation. I mean, it gives us clues that we can then use trigonometry and such and spectroscopy. But it's all the electromagnetic spectrum. So it'll be interesting to see when we add another type of phenomena into this ability to calculate things, such as gravitational waves. I mean, I'm hoping that at some point we are able to develop equipment that can find the gravitational wave version of the cosmic microwave background. That would be fascinating.
I don't think you've mentioned very much of the cosmic microwave background, 2.73 degrees Kelvin. And so you might want to go there sometime in the future, right? KQLIW.
Okay, I mean, it's a fascinating subject. It doesn't really add that much to how we know the absolute values of temperature and mass and distance and velocity. An interesting little aspect of CMB that sometimes people escape is that you actually see a degree of Doppler shifting taking place when you detect the background microwave, and that's the Doppler shift of our movement in relation to through the rest of the universe and the background microwaves. So you can kind of get a measurement of local velocities in, you know, in the measurements that you take of the cosmic microwave background. But I'm sure there's a lot of things that I could dig up to say about that. It's a fascinating study, and it goes to the very root of inflation theory and people's attempts to explain how the universe came into existence. And you can't get any more metaphysical than that. So I think I tried to kind of give you the surface level of how we're able to figure things out. I may have said them too fast, and I said them without any illustrations. And once again, anyone really interested in the subject should kind of wander over to a web browser and type astronomy.ac2gs.com, and you will find hours and hours of an astronomy professor giving details on every aspect of this. So any questions, comments, suggestions, statements, what have you? Yes, Hank.
Just wanted to say thank you. This is fascinating. It's great to have an authoritative source that we can interact with. And I think this is a really super addition to the TechNet. Once again, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Hank. I actually enjoy doing this. I get a lot of fun out of it, and the more people participate and interact, the happier I am. I don't want to give a dry presentation for half-bored people. I like people to engage in the subject, and I'm more than willing to kind of go with whatever question or slightly tangential comment that's based upon the material. So I appreciate your participation tonight. So, Dick, do you want me to go to another little question that someone asked, or you think we've had enough science for tonight?
We can tolerate a little bit more science. We're not running short on time, right? So if you've got another subject, please proceed.
Okay. I mean, this was a question that was asked just an hour or two before the TechNet came on through the email. Once again, the email can be mailbag@limartech.net, or you can just send it to roy@ac2gs.com. But gentleman asked, the way he phrased it was, what is Einstein's unified field theory? Sounds important, right? Well, you know, unfortunately, Einstein never really finished that. It was the ultimate solution to everything, and he really worked hard at Princeton to try and pull it off. The problem is that although he was almost, you could say, the father of both relativity and quantum mechanics, because he did get a Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, which was really kind of the early times of quantum mechanics, the two don't really get together very well. There's a whole bunch of problems. One is that relativity is really a classical physics concept. It's not quite as weird as quantum mechanics, which is definitely not classical, although it takes bits and pieces of classical wave mechanics and does very curious things with it. So the trick was to unify relativity and quantum mechanics, and for the most part, the biggest problem was doing something with that darn gravity. Let me drop. The problem is that gravity is two very different concepts in both of those fields. In relativity, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, gravity is not even a true force. Gravity is what's called the pseudo force. Pseudo forces are different depending upon your frame of reference. And so to Einstein, it was not a force, but simply a distortion, a warping, curvature, whatever you would want to call it, of space-time itself. Mass warps space-time, and space-time tells mass where to travel. And that, to him, was gravity. Quantum mechanics is different. Quantum mechanics treats it like just one of the fundamental forces. And there are even a particle theorized called the graviton that's exchanged during gravitational forces that relativity doesn't allow for. So it's a big problem trying to put those two together. And Einstein spent a great deal of his later life in Princeton trying to work it out, and he couldn't. Now, there's something called the quantum field theory, which is not a unified field theory, and it's very esoteric, but it amounts to the fact that everything is just excitations of fields, and what we think of as solid objects is just our imagination at work. But Einstein's unified field theory would theoretically put everything together and explain everything as different aspects of the same exact thing. Let me drop. As an example, in quantum mechanics, they've been trying to put together all the four fundamental forces of nature into different aspects of the same exact thing at high energy levels. The concept being that at the very beginning of the Big Bang, when temperatures were ridiculously hot and energy levels were very hot, everything was convertible to everything else. And so they've been trying to put things together. Now, long ago, before quantum mechanics, they kind of put together the electric field and the magnetic field, and we call it the electromagnetic field or the electromagnetic force. So that was done for them. Recently, though, they took something called the weak nuclear force, and they put that together with the electric force, and they call it the electroweak force. So they had success for that. They're working real hard on the nuclear strong force. So they'll have three out of the four forces combined in a grand unified theory. And once again, the trouble is gravity. So gravity always kind of confuses people, and there's really no good answer to how to deal with gravity in quantum mechanics. Let me... But physicists are incredibly creative people, and even if there's nothing there, sometimes they make stuff up because it sounds good. And that might or might not explain something that I'm particularly like called string theory, which suggests the really weird possibility that the fundamental nature of everything is not particularly fields, is not particularly particles. It's these little string-like objects that are approximately one Planck length in dimension. Planck length is the theoretical smallest length you can have. It's like a pixel for a computer terminal. You can't have half of a pixel light up. You can only have a pixel or no pixel. So that's a Planck's constant length. And so the trouble is, to make all the math work, you have to have something that sounds ridiculous, like 11 different dimensions. Now, we're just getting used to four dimensions, you know, space and time. But you need 11 dimensions for this, so a lot of people kind of don't like it. It's been around for 20, 25 years, maybe. It hasn't really been thought through. The equations are maybe half complete. It doesn't really predict anything yet, which scientists hate, because the whole point of these exercises is you have a theory. The theory makes a prediction. You go into an experiment. You find out if that occurs or not. And if it doesn't, you throw out the theory and you move to the next one. If a theory doesn't present any conclusion that's testable, you're left with just philosophy 101. So that's string theory. And that kind of goes back to the question, what is Einstein's unified field theory? I wish Einstein was still alive. I'm sure he could give us some more insight into the subject. I'm going to keep my spiel on Einstein's unified field theory. The same gentleman asked about longitudinal waves and scalar waves. I don't know if you care to travel down that rabbit hole with me, Dick.
You doubled with somebody. Who was the other person?
Sorry, it was me in 1YDY, and it was just an odd comment about the cosmological constant and whether or not it was a mistake in Einstein's eventual calculations.
You've got that one, Roy.
Well, historically, he fessed up that it was his greatest goof. But in retrospect, although it wasn't exactly useful for the purpose that he set it up with, it really is very useful for including in the equation to describe the accelerating nature of the expansion of the universe. His object was the complete opposite. His object was he had believed in the steady-state universe, and the constant was supposed to correct for any fluctuations and damp them down instead of accelerating them. So he thought of it as his greatest stupid move, but in the end, it was actually, it's still being used. It's just being used in a slightly different way.
That was kind of my point. You know, he was very well known for describing the universe as being marble rather than wood, and he was looking to dampen things down and show support a steady state view.
Yes, but he wasn't the only guy. I think that was the majority view back in those days before Hubble had his say. And you have to realize that Hubble's work is after Einstein. So Hubble had time on his side. So, yeah. But again, the trouble is, and the trouble has always been, that sometimes you take things for granted. And Einstein took the steady state theory for granted. And maybe he should have known better, who knows, but, you know, he fell prey to that, and we all do, in many ways.
Yeah, he didn't want to be controversial, and maybe 98% of all the smart scientists around him were positive the universe was a steady-state object, and you'd be very radical if you predicted anything non-steady-state, so therefore, he didn't question it, he went along with it. I suspect that when Hubble was coming up with his Hubble constant, showing an expanding in a non-steady state universe, I'll bet you at first his material wasn't accepted. I bet you he had some flack at first. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, pretty much any revolutionary theory or finding is going to cause that pushback. I mean, you say that Einstein, and to a degree, yeah, he didn't want to generate any more trouble than he had to. But if you really think about the things that he's published, they were very problematic to this day. There are still a lot of people scratching their heads. They don't like the idea that time and space are relative, that two events that you see happening simultaneously doesn't necessarily mean that another witness sees them at the same time. They could be years apart to those people. It really annoys people. So I think he decided that he was going to hedge his bets with the static universe and use his chips for the revolutionary concept that the ultimate constant in the universe is the speed of light.
It looks like electromagnetic waves in free space travel at the speed of light. It looks like the gravitational wave, at least the part that you feel from it with a LIGO experiment, it travels at the speed of light. So speed of light affects electromagnetics. It affects gravity. Inside of a black hole, the gravity is so strong that you have to go have an escape velocity greater than the speed of light, and therefore light cannot come back out of a black hole. Gravitational waves travel at the speed of light, and yet you sense the gravity of the mass inside of a black hole. So it looks like the gravitons are not limited by the event horizon of a black hole. That's not an easy one to explain, is it, Roy? KC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
I've mentioned this in the past. One of the problems is that people don't really like the idea that force carriers are insensitive to the forces that they carry. And one of the best reasons that I have to explain that is because you'd have a feedback mechanism that would never end. So electromagnetic waves really don't interact, at least until you put them very high energy and they have nonlinear reactions. They don't respond to electrical magnetic fields. They just go their merry way. Gravitons, if they do exist, the theoretical graviton is unaffected by gravitational fields. They are invariant to them. They don't feel them, and so they're not trapped by them in black holes. So they go on their merry way at the speed of causality, which is the speed of light in a vacuum.
Does that suggest that a gravity wave, a gravitational wave, can propagate through a massive object like the Earth or like a super large star? Can the gravitational wave propagate through a supermassive star with essentially no interaction? If you're on the far side of that star with a LIGO experiment, do you measure the exact same magnitude? I suspect the answer is yes. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yeah, my answer would be yes. The beauty of gravity is incredibly weak in relation to the other three fundamental forces, the nuclear strong force, the electromagnetic force, and nuclear weak force. By something like 10 to the 10 with 25 zeros is the next weakest nuclear weak force. So it's a very weak force. What it makes up is that it travels through infinite space, and nothing shields it and nothing neutralizes it. Electrostatics are very easily attracted to each other and tend to neutralize. The strong and weak nuclear forces are very localized forces, but gravity can go on and on and on. And so gravitational waves will go right through the very fabric of space-time that a star or a black hole is sitting next to and have no real effect. It just goes right through it like, well, I won't even say like a hot knife through butter, because it's probably even easier than that.
WS2M.
Cool.
Yeah, I believe they proved that with the LIGO, when that just the last time that the gravitational wave came through and went through the two LIGO units, one in Louisiana and the other one in the state of Washington. And then they pointed the satellites and other telescopes in the direction of, you know, because of the two LIGO locations, they knew what direction to look to. And sure enough, eventually they did see a light coming from that area, and they knew that it was a direct relationship to the gravitational wave. And then they figured out that, well, the gravitational wave just went right through everything, went through all the different mass, eventually got to Earth, but the electromagnetic wave wandered around a bit, you know, it through the whole billions of years, whatever it was, billions of light years, it didn't take the same path, the direct path that the gravitational wave took. So the gravity won out as far as, not that it was faster, but they were both on the speed of light. They just took different directions. As, you know, one might think of it as, you know, one was going down a crooked road, the other one was going straight. Back to you, Roy.
might actually say that gravitational waves don't suffer from multipath distortion. But really, if you think about it, if gravitational forces were locked in a black hole, then what would be the force drawing anything into the black hole?
You could say the black hole would never form in the first place if the gravitational, if the graviton or gravitational wave couldn't propagate out of there. When it comes to the nuclear strong force, I believe that's the one that's holding the particles of the nucleus together. Those protons that are positively charged in the nucleus, they want to repel each other and fly out. But the nuclear strong force is holding them together. A very short-range force, but it does that job. What's the main job being done by the nuclear weak force, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW, TechNet?
Well, of course, the nuclear strong force has a few different things that it does. It binds the individual quarks together into protons and neutrons, and it also binds the protons and neutrons together in the nucleus. And you'll notice that there's no situation where there's two protons and nothing else in the nucleus. There's usually always a number of neutrons to act as a cushion against the positively charged protons that the strong force interacts with. The weak force mediates the radioactive decay of nuclei. The things that give us alpha decay and beta decay and such are mediated by the weak nuclear force.
What would be different, Roy, if there was no nuclear weak force? What would be different with the decay functions?
Well, without that energy interplay, they would not be able to decay, so there would be no unstable radioactive isotopes. They would pretty much be frozen without a means of lowering their energy level. This is a route that they can take to release energy. If you lock down the weak force, it can't use that route, and so there's no intermediate energy carrier that allows for that energy transfer.
Do you have a personal opinion, Roy, as to whether or not an anti-gravity machine is possible? I mean, there are those who want to believe that some of the UFOs we've seen have conquered gravity, and they've got the equivalent of an anti-gravity machine, and that's something to do with their propulsion. They don't seem to be emitting a material like a rocket ship engine. So do you have an opinion as to whether or not it's possible to reverse gravitational force and use it as a thrusting mechanism? AC2GS, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Well, there's a strict definition for anti-gravity, and that's the one you're pretty much using in your description. Anti-gravity is not simply an opposing force to gravity. It's a means to shield oneself against the force of gravity. And unfortunately, there's nothing in theoretical physics that would explain anything capable of doing that. Again, it depends upon which avenue you want to take about gravity. If gravity is relativistic, then mass distorts space-time. So how do you undistort space-time, and what do you use if not mass? I mean, there are some people who are a little confused about what antimatter is, and they sort of think that antimatter is anti-everything, so they think it's anti-gravity as well, and they think that a piece of antimatter would be repelled gravitationally, but it hasn't been proved. And they've actually done studies to see if there's a gravitational effect on antimatter, and it seems to obey the same exact laws as matter does, as far as gravity. So There's no theoretical underpinning for anti-grav. I hope personally that someone figures it out because it will revolutionize space travel. But I have not the faintest clue how they would go about it. And sometimes when I read these weird articles where they're describing anti-gravity devices and vertexes and superconducting things, I cry for the lack of understanding of what the hell they're writing about. But despite it all, I hope it comes true. I hope some very brilliant guy just rewrites the entire theory of temporal mechanics and gravitational quantum mechanics and figures a way around all these things. Because they've been trying to do that repeatedly, and maybe someday, I don't know. I'm not optimistic, but I'd like it to see it.
199.
Please comment.
Let me see if I can get my thoughts straight on this, but I'm delighted with the way you've taken this conversation. I have been reading lately about entanglement. I'm sure you're familiar with the term. And they have talked about entanglement of particles, which, of course, is entanglement of things, matter. But it turns out that there has just been a finding that not only space or matter can be entangled, but also time. There was an experiment, I don't have it at my fingertips here because I wasn't expecting to bring it up tonight, but I will send you the reference to the mailbag address. And there was an experiment that was just conducted in Israel. And I have the reference of what it was all about, but it basically boils down to that particles separated in time also seem to be able to exhibit the same characteristics. The thing that I'm interested in here is that you're talking about matter, I'm talking about particles, which are just smaller versions of matter. I just wonder if you have anything that'll interconnect these. Back to you.
Well, quantum mechanics is a very quantum entanglement is a very interesting idea. It really annoyed, again, Albert Einstein, who again wrote one of the basic articles that form the entire concept. There are lab experiments that demonstrate a quantum entanglement in photons. You can entangle particles that are either mass particles, such as electrons and their spins. You can quantumly entangle photons and their polarization angles. If they're polarized circular or horizontal or vertical or what have you. So both of those can. I'm not quite sure what is meant by entangling time. I think you're still entangling an object, but in time. So it's still a quantum entangled particle, either energy-carrying particle or a mass-containing particle, but they both have been demonstrated. And they are fascinating, but Einstein hated it. He called it spooky action at a distance.
Yes, thank you. I'm very familiar with with his reaction, but Schrodinger disagreed with him, if I remember correctly, and that's where Schrodinger's cat came from. But anyway, I think what I would better do is let me get you the reference, and maybe you can have a look at this and see if there's something down this path. Hey, if this net is responsible for coming up with how flying saucers can get from here to there quicker, and we don't have to go through all the several lifetimes it would take us to get to another star, I'd be happy. Back to you.
Well, that would be great. I wonder if Sweden gives a Nobel Prize for a technical net, but that would be interesting to find out. Schrodinger's cat is slightly different. It's really not entanglement. It's to try and explain to people the very difficult concept, which is not solely quantum mechanical. It goes back to classical wave mechanics and something called superposition, that you can describe something as the sum of two states. And the same way that you can do that in classical wave mechanics, you can do it with probability of things occurring in real life. And Schrodinger's cat is a cat in a box with a little radioactive poison that has a given half-life and has a 50-50 chance of having been triggered and killed the cat or not triggered yet. And so the enclosed cat has a superposition of being 50% alive and 50% dead until you open the box, look inside, observe him, and by doing that you collapse the wave function down where it's 100% probable of either living or dead. So that's what Schrodinger's cat is about. That's about superposition, not quite about entanglement.
Roy, thank you for explaining that. I'm NY9A, my name is George, and I'll be back next week. But in the meantime, would you please recite your email address one more time so I can be sure to get these references to you?
Yes. You can either send them to mailbag@limarktech.net or simply roy@ac2gs.com. Anything that you put with the domain ac2gs.com will go to me anyway, but Roy is as good a prefix as any.
Thank you, Roy. 73, NY9A clear.
Very good. Any other questions, comments, statements, or suggestions for future Nobel Prizes?
A quick question on gravity.
Yes, give me your gravity question.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, this is WA2VDH. My question has to do with the orbital conditions of the planets and the fact that gravity appears to be going at the speed of light. Doesn't this mean that, for example, the Earth is orbiting where the Sun was 8 minutes ago? And wouldn't that tend to destabilize the orbits of planets? And as you get further out, the point where the planet is orbiting is further and further misaligned with where the Sun actually is. Wouldn't that cause a destabilization? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the simplest way to answer that, I guess, is the fact that it doesn't, because we're still circling the Sun. But we're not really circling the center of gravity at the center of the Sun. The axis for our rotation is off the center axis of the Sun. And it is complicated, but I think it's consistent even over the time frame. So I don't think there is any kind of temporal distortion that causes the orbit to decay.
I've got a guess on this one, Roy. Let me drop it. If I could see a radio wave coming out from an antenna, it would look, the leading edge of that radio wave would look like a bubble of expanding material. That bubble is moving at the speed of light in all directions. And because of the antenna pattern, the bubble is brighter in some areas than others, but it's a spherical object moving at the speed of light, and the very next wave, the very next cycle, is another bubble inside of that one, and they're all concentric with each other. When it comes to gravitational gravitons, I am guessing they are a spherical wave moving at the speed of light coming out from the Sun, so that's a spherical bubble. As the Earth moves in its orbit, yes, the particular gravity wave you're sensing now, and a month from now you'll be sensing a gravity wave that was issued a month earlier, but still, we're moving along that surface of a spherical bubble, and the fact that that particular portion of the wave we're seeing is older doesn't matter. At any instant of time, you use your gravity sensing machine and find out where's the peak of the gravity, and it will always point toward the center of the sun. That's my belief. I may have the wrong physical image here, if you know what I mean, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I understand that, and I can see the imagery. The problem, though, is that planetary and solar orbits are not circular. They're elliptical. They have eccentricities. So there's a little bit of a wobble that goes on, but I don't think that the temporal aspect of it plays that much of a part of the delay of the gravitational field in relation to the movement, because I think in order to have any kind of demonstrable effect, the movements would have to be exceedingly faster than they are. The proof of the pudding is that all these orbits maintain themselves, so obviously there's no temporal distortion going on with gravitational fields that are destabilizing it all. It may simply be a factor of that it's a couple of thousands of billions of orders of magnitude too low to have an effect, or there's something else. I mean, I'll take a look-see in the literature and see if I can come up with something. It's an interesting concept, and that's what I like about these interactions, that people bring me questions that I haven't really thought of.
Yeah, the image that I just described would be for a perfectly circular orbit, which is perfectly possible. However, by way of Kepler's laws and Newton's laws, gravity always obeys the inverse square law, so you half the distance between you and the source of gravity, you're going to sense four times as much gravity. You put that together with the laws of motion, and you get elliptical orbits, which trace an equal amount of area for an equal amount of time, and so you can still have these perfectly spherical waves of gravity. In close, they're strong. Far away, they're weak. Inverse square law. But you allow a planetary motion around that mass center object called Sun. And elliptical orbits are not violating any of that. And they seem to work very well. So how old is the particular gravity wave that you're experiencing at this instant of time in your orbit? Almost doesn't matter, because each individual gravity wave is a perfectly spherical object, is my belief. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
WH4YO, I have a question on something about what you're talking about.
Your signal is quite noisy, but we're hearing you, we're hearing every one of your words, so go right ahead, Joe.
Let me see if I can improve that. Hang on a minute. How's this? Much better?
Fantastic. What did you do?
Change radios. I'm not sure if you should qualify this as a question under what you're sort of talking about with the relationship to gravity or a space question, but here goes. Maybe it's a simple question, but I'm not sure what the answer is going to be. The Earth rotates at roughly about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. We're rotating around the sun around 66,000 miles per hour around the sun. And from what I believe I've heard, the whole shebang is going someplace at about 18,000 miles an hour moving. What direction are we moving to or from, and what is causing us to go in that direction? Back to you.
I'm going to make some guesses and pass it over to Roy. But there's about 4 degrees of freedom here. We're rotating around our own axis. Our planet is rotating around the sun in a slightly elliptical orbit. the sun is in a arm, the Sagittarius arm, I think it's called, of our particular galaxy. So we're rotating around the center of our galaxy. Once every 250 years, I think, is the number. Our galaxy is rotating around a mass center of the local galactic group. So our whole galaxy is moving. Our local galactic group is moving with reference to the whole observable universe. So we got lots of degrees of freedom there. And the fastest of all of those motions is probably our local galactic group moving in some particular direction that I don't know right now with reference to the rest of our universe. So let's see, that's a 4 or 5 degrees of freedom there in the way we're moving. It's a little bit like the flea that's on the dog. The dog is walking down the center of the train. The train is moving at a certain number of miles an hour and so on. You can add up all of those velocities. AC2GS, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, it gets confusing after a while, doesn't it? Well, you also have usually a super galactic cluster on top of a local cluster. They're usually string-like filaments material. You can't really kind of get a sense whether we're involved in one, but you can see out in the far distances examples of that. So that's having rotation. And then you have our friend the Hubble constant, which is the expansion of space. Whether you want to describe that as a velocity or just space expanding around us, it's a matter of, you know, everything is relative, as the old saying goes. So there's a lot of movement all over the darn place, and Albert would tell you that it's not that important. You basically have to decide on your frame of reference and stick with that.
Yeah, Joe, you might have an additional question on this one. You got it, Joe.
No, I think you'd give me enough answers for a while if you think about it. I never stopped to think about all the other factors, like we're rotating around the center of a galaxy, the galaxy's rotating around some other central point in space you talk about, but is the whole thing moving in a particular direction, or is it just one thing rotating over something bigger than itself? Like at the end of the day, how fast is the flea going inside the train, right?
In the case of the flea and the train, we can add up all the individual velocities with reference to the guy that's standing at the station. But if now you want to go through the motions of the Earth in its rotation around its axis, and the Earth revolving around the Sun, and the Sun revolving around the center of, revolving with our particular arm of other stars within our galaxy, and the galaxy rotating around its local mass centers and so on. It goes on and on and on. It's going to keep us busy a while, but Roy's going to straighten this all out for us. AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS here to clear this all up. Again, unfortunately, everything is relative. There are no absolute velocities, I'm afraid. There is no absolute time, I'm afraid. The only constant is the speed of light. And so velocity ultimately depends on which frame of reference you decide to choose. If you decide to choose the center of the Earth, then you can forget about all the other mess of galaxies and galactic clusters and galactic superclusters and Hubble's field of expanding space, and if we're in a hyper-dimensional multiverse that's doing other things as well. So it's all relative, ultimately.
It's probably about time we go over to the space report, Roy. So do you want to say anything final before we close this science and physics report tonight? AC2GS with physics and science report number 19. Just about to conclude. K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
A quick question.
Go ahead with the quick question.
I think this is Mike, number 2, K1MJM. Maybe we'll save it for next week. We keep talking about gravity as a gravity wave. If gravity is truly a wave, doesn't it conform to constructive and destructive interference, and it doesn't sound like that applies to gravity. Just throw that out. Maybe it's too long of a conversation. We should pick it up next week. K1MJM, back over to you, Dick.
Yeah, the so-called three-body problem in space, where you've got three objects going around each other, you can come up with a very good approximation by using good computer programs, but there's no exact formula for that. But it looks like gravity, from what I understand, is always an attractive force. I don't think anybody has ever found a gravitational repulsive force. See what Roy's got to say on that. AC2GS, K2RIW.
See, the problem, though, is semantics. We have to try not to mix up gravitons, which are theoretical things, with gravitational waves, which are not the same. Gravitational waves are distortion in space-time, stretching and contracting. It is theoretically possible to superimpose two gravitational waves that are 180 degrees out of phase and produce a null. But that's a gravitational wave, not gravity itself. The waves would not fluctuate, but you would still have the force of gravity or the overall distortion of space-time. You just wouldn't have the ripple effect.
One of the places where you can get a kind of gravitational cancellation, if you choose a point between the Earth and the Moon, which I'm not sure of the exact location, but I think it's a 90% of the distance between Earth toward Moon. You put a bowling ball there, the amount of lunar gravity it senses moving it toward the moon, the amount of Earth gravity it senses moving it toward the Earth, you choose the right position, you can get zero effect, microgravity, so to speak. And one of the puzzles that was given to me once by a guy from Stony Brook University is you got two bowling balls at that exact location. They're at that magic place where they sense no difference in gravity, so they're going to sit still with reference to Earth and Moon. And now you physically move one of the bowling balls 1 foot closer to the Moon. You move the other bowling ball 1 foot closer to the Earth. You wait long enough, the first bowling ball is going to hit the Moon. The second bowling ball is going to hit the Earth. And the question is, which one is going to hit first? I'll let you guys think about that for the next week. AC2GS for any comments, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. So we'll have people simmer on that, and maybe we'll find some topic related to that. I just wanted, before we shut this down for the night, to remind people of a couple of places that they can go looking for things. If you have a browser open, just type in candle.ac2gs.com, and that will take you to the YouTube of the history of the chemistry of candles, which is a very enjoyable presentation. And the other is astronomy.ac2gs.com, where a very smart astronomy professor shows all of these things on a white chalk talk type of situation. So feel free to try either of those, and to contact me, once again, is mailbag@limarktech.net or even roy@ac2gs.com. And thank you very much for listening. And we'll try and come up with something interesting for next week.
Well done, Roy. And I'm getting some very positive feedback from what you guys are doing, what you're doing with your science and physics report. Now comes space report number 289. And Paul, you got the floor. And did that most recent... Did Falcon... do its most recent report. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a ball.
Very good, wait for the tone. Okay, and very well done, Roy. And this is WS2N. And, yeah, as far as the distance between the gravitational distance between the Earth and the Moon, that's an important factor. When they launched all the Apollo missions to the Moon,
you know, they launch it with a certain size rocket. And, you know, we have rockets that today, you know, you can get to the moon actually in 9 hours. But the problem is you wouldn't be able to stop. So you would need a gigantic rocket.